This is CliffCentral.com.
There is a new book that has been written by one of our favorite authors, one of our favorite academics, someone I've spoken to before on the show and who's received acclaim all over the world for some of the very brave work he's been doing. It's a book called How to Have Impossible Conversations, a very practical guide. The author is Peter Boghossian, who's on the line with me now from the United States. Peter, how are you?
I am fantastic, and I sincerely appreciate having me on and doing these conversations. Again, they've been some of the best conversations I've ever had.
I really appreciate that. It's a great pleasure to speak to you, and you've done some sterling stuff in the last few years, but well done on the new book.
Oh, thank you. I did it because I co-authored it with James Lindsay, and I'm past the point of concern and into the point of worry now about the way we're not talking to each other. And when we do, quote unquote, talk to each other, we scream at each other, or everyone's a Nazi or a bigot or a homophobe or a racist or a fascist. There's no space. There's no space for people to change their mind. There's no space for people to wonder. There's no space for people to be honest about things. And I think it's killing us on multiple levels.
Well, there's no room for anything other than the binary, and someone is either good or bad, and there's no nuance, and it just makes everything It makes everything so bland.
Yeah, and I think it has two consequences. One is that, so I'm doing an event in London, and people are absolutely freaking out and going crazy and screaming at me, and of course it's the usual thing, you're a Nazi, etc. And the reason is because, so the three of us are doing this event primarily are liberal atheists, and one of the organizers is a Christian, and he's putting on a prayer service. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we literally wrote a book entitled How to Have Impossible Conversations, and we're having a conversation in front of a diverse audience. And I think that we should linger on that for a second. You know, people use the word diversity, diversity, diversity. Do you get that in South Africa too?
All the time. And they misuse the word, but tell me what your problem with it is.
Well, my problem is that people use it to mean two things: only superficial characteristics like sexual orientation, or in other words, being gay or being black. I don't know the phraseology you'd use, but part of the problem is that diversity means homogeneity of thought. So when people say to you, oh, we need diversity, it's not what you think they mean. So, for example, if a black person doesn't share an opinion or doesn't share their opinion or the opinion that they hold, which is really in the fringe of the left lunatic intersectional ideology, then that's not really a black person, right?
Right.
That's not – they call the name like you're a coconut, that, like my friend Fasil Amutar gets called all the time. So, you know, you're black on the outside but white on the inside. So they really mean it's a mechanism to promote their ideology. It's like a mimetic spread, and they've created all of these ideas and safeguards. They've created, you know, institutional mechanisms to prevent us from talking to each other, like bias response teams where people can get reported for incidents, diversity boards. But these are just ways to divide us. They're ways to prevent us from speaking honestly and openly with each other, and prevent us from wondering and building friendships. It's a freaking calamity.
Well, it also tells you quite a lot, I would imagine, about the nature of these groups who are trying to prevent people from talking openly, honestly, and in a nuanced fashion, because I suppose they're very easily threatened. They're the same people who claim everything is offensive. They're the same people who talk about diversity but never have any diversity of thought. Why do you think this is happening, and especially why do you think it's happening with young people? Why are they so desperate to belong to either an identity political group or some kind of marginalized victimhood Olympics, rather than have conversations with depth and discussions that add value? But, you know, where two adult people are conversing on a matter of perhaps philosophical importance or ideological difference, things that really make for great conversation.
Yeah, how should I live my life? It's a Socratic question. Before I answer that, I want to go back to what you said before. So I think, after having studied and thrown myself at this for a few years now, I think that at the core, they do not believe that the moral claims that they hold can be rationally derived. I truly believe that at this point. In other words, you would have no problem having a conversation with someone, for example, anthropogenic global warming. You know, why is the world warming? Is it carbon? What is it? It doesn't matter. Gun death, I don't know, whatever, immigration. If you just present the evidence and look at it. And so if you think that there's sufficient reason to justify the beliefs you have, well, then of course you'd have a conversation with someone. Why wouldn't you? I mean, unless there's some weird thing like they're, you know, a serial killer or something. But I think that these folks do not believe at core that their beliefs can be derivable by reason. And at some level, it's a matter of self-deception and dishonesty. And I sincerely believe that.
What a terrible situation to find yourself in, where you actually have to, you have to abandon good old debate, argument, rational thinking, principles of evidence, proof. And instead, you have to almost enter into a game of lies where the whole purpose is to label someone as being unable to articulate an argument before they've even had the chance to, just so you don't lose.
Yeah. And you know what? That's the most charitable interpretation of what's going on. Because what's really going on is this idea that they think they're better people by not talking to you because they have a word for that. It's called platforming. So if they talk to you, I don't know if you saw the video of the kids in the street at Dave Rubin's event when they blocked the very elderly woman on a walker, the Antifa thugs. But they think that they're better people. I mean, that's Steven Pinker's idea. Nobody acts like this because they're trying to be bad. It's that they think they're good and then they act like this. So they're better people for not talking to you. And they're better people for not allowing a speaker to come to a university, for example, and have a debate. It doesn't even matter what the debate is about. And so what they have to do is they have to shut down the whole discourse. They bring blowhorns in, they block entryways, they rip speaker wires out. That happened at an event at Portland State University when James Damore, the Google engineer, we hosted him. So this is a very, very complicated problem. And not only are we do we not know how to talk to each other, people think it's they're really good, virtuous, decent people because they don't talk to other people and they don't let other people talk to other people. And on top of that, you see university professors acting like infants, screaming at events, shouting down speakers. And so what the kids see is the kids see these professors engaging in these behaviors and they model them. It's a catastrophe, I'm telling you. I am sincerely worried at this point.
Well, your book may be some kind of antidote to this because you start at basic principles. And by asking how you can have impossible conversations, I don't think you're going to get a lot of people in that mindset that you just described who are able to answer that question. Maybe your book is going to be like manna from heaven. I mean, best case scenario, it becomes prescribed reading for anyone who finds themselves possessed by an idea or an ideology and is unable to escape from it and have meaningful interactions with other human beings. We find this is happening with young people on college campuses, particularly in the Northeast where you are. But is it something that you is it something you think we can dial the hysteria down on a little? Is it something that you think we could reverse? What kind of reaction are you having to it so far?
I think the reaction has been overwhelmingly positive so far. My problem about the book, and I'll criticize my own book, is that the people who most need it won't read it. And so, you know, I set up these How to Have Impossible Conversations booths along with a few people like Anthony Magnabosco, who has a YouTube channel, or Reed Nicewander, and we write down conversation questions and then we talk to complete strangers about these things. But the problem is that you really ultimately want to talk to people who won't buy or read the book. So listen, if you're listening to this right now and you're thinking, well, you know, fuck that guy. You know, those guys are Nazis. They're, you know, men and cis and hetero. Here's what I have to say to you. It's a very simple question. Ask yourself, take a cherished belief you hold and ask yourself a simple question. How could this belief be wrong? You don't have to tell yourself it is wrong. Just ask yourself that question. Mm. I hold this moral belief about something. I hold this moral belief that we shouldn't have conversations with people or we need to punch people who disagree with us. Okay, how could that belief be wrong? And if you cannot sincerely and again, you're not telling anybody else. You're not telling me. You're not telling anybody. You're asking yourself that question. And if you cannot generate a sincere and honest answer. And that little voice inside your head will be telling you if you're honest with yourself. Chances are the belief that you have is not one you should hold.
But how many people are honestly holding these beliefs, and how many of them are just people who are trying to get some social points, trying to improve their status in their own peer group? I mean, we're talking often about, these are not self-actualized human beings. Very seldom do you find people who are ideologically possessed like this to be self-actualized. In fact, you find that they've probably glommed onto an ideology because they feel desperately alone and needy of affirmation. I'm not asking you to be a psychologist to everyone, but you have to have picked up on some of this in your work in academia and in writing and in presenting these workshops.
Yeah, the only thing people like enjoy more than being right is to belong, is to have a sense of community. And people go into those communities, particularly in today's day and age, that share their moral values with them. And once that happens, those beliefs, those moral values become very, very hard, difficult to revise. So I don't know what percentage of people actually believe this and what percentage of people pretend to believe it to gain social capital. I'll tell you a quick story. I was at a faculty meeting, and you know, one thing led to another, and I'm sitting at a table with, I won't mention this individual's name, but he was one of the architects of the whole safe spaces, trigger warnings, microaggression things at this university. And I said to him, I'll just say sir as a placeholder for his name. I said, sir, do you honestly believe, I mean, you know, just you and me, here we are, we're sitting now, do you really believe that in the 2,400 years of recorded history, from the brightest minds, Kant, Newt, Galileo, you honestly believe that it has only been within the last 3 or 4 years that we have discovered the timeless, eternal, immutable truth of cultural appropriation? And this individual looked at me with total sincerity and said, yes, I do.
It's a self-righteousness there, huh?
Yeah, and it's a kind of tragedy, you know? It's a kind of, this ideology has totally swept over, and it was like a blitzkrieg without anyone knowing there's a war, right? It just completely came over and institutionalized everything in its sight. And you know, now you see all these signs, I don't know how it is over there around Portland, but all these kind of like 1984-ish George Orwellian mantras around diversity is our strength or what have you. And the, you know, when you ask people some pretty basic, simple questions about this, they don't have the faintest clue about what they believe or why they should believe it.
No, in fact, the amount of research that they've done into positions they hold very passionately is minimal.
Yeah, and here's the other problem, if I may. So Brett Weinstein terms this idea laundering. This is a really cool concept, and I think it's important for people to understand. So let's say a bunch of people get together and they have some moral urge. Like they have a feeling they have. So they have some intuition. Like, well, we'll go with the cultural appropriation thing. Cultural appropriation is wrong. Well, what they do is then they get together and they form a journal, like a peer-reviewed academic journal. And then they will publish a paper or a series of papers or dedicate the maybe the whole journal or maybe a single issue to cultural appropriation. People will peer review, in other words, experts in the fields will review it, and then they'll publish it, and then it will be laundered, so it will come out on the other side as knowledge. So then when you ask them, well, how do you know cultural appropriation is wrong? Well, then they just point to the journals that themselves they made up.
Well, this
so
is
this is
relevant to a discussion you and I had last time we spoke. You published a very interesting series of articles and academic pieces that have been written in journals by you and two of your colleagues, one of them James, the co-author of your book. And it was received with absolute horror by, you know, gender studies people, grievance studies people, all of these particularly the academics who have been held in the highest of esteem within the academic world, and really are just peddling complete nonsense and making lives for themselves where there are studies that shouldn't exist because they have no empirical value. You guys went to the trouble of exposing just how valueless these are. And what happened? You were the bad guys. Somehow these grown adults who are stealing money from teenagers and young adults perpetually, because they're going to be in debt for much of their grown life, to teach them nonsense that has no practical application in the real world and won't help them to get a career or earn money or do anything productive. You expose them. Somehow you guys were the bad guys?
That's correct. And I was brought up on formal academic charges because of it, and it was a witch hunt. And so I think that's a consequence of just not being honest with yourself, right? And, you know, I guess, and I was Pollyanna in respect, in retrospect, you know, I was thinking at least some people would say, well, maybe there were problems with these journals. To back up, what we did is we published a series of bogus, intentionally broken, morally horrific papers arguing insane things. And, you know, instead of, if you did that in virtually any other field, let me phrase it this way. If you did that in any non-ideological field, people would thank you. Thank you for, it's called pen testing or penetration testing. Mm-hmm. Thank you for testing our journals. Thank you for making sure we're up on our game. You know, you want to bring bombs through the TSA and you sneak them through and then you tell everybody exactly how you did it. Thank you, because our families fly on those planes and we don't want some lunatic to blow up the plane, right? So, but instead of that, we got vitriol, anger, racist, Nazis, you hate gays, whatever. I mean, it's so insincere. But I'm not – I think it's really important to not – it's not a question of whether or not we should blame vicious ideologues for being in these positions. I think that their cognitions really have been hijacked by a kind of – they've been parasitized by social justice and intersectionality. And it's a terrible problem, because it – I don't know. It must do something bizarre to the moral – part of the mind. It's like the moral mind overrides the rational part of the mind, and it causes people to say, do, and believe truly insane things.
But it isn't moral.
And the question is,
I mean, it's not even moral. You said it just now. Sometimes it's more important for some people to belong than to be right. And right. I think
well, maybe, they think it's moral.
But maybe it's just completely, yeah, it's just this herd instinct, this mob mentality. I saw that Douglas Murray's just written a book, which I've only just started reading, about the madness of mobs. In fact, I can give you the right title of it in a second, so I can just do him the service of not misnaming his book.
The madness of crowds.
Yeah, is what it is.
Just speaking to Douglas the other day, his book is really doing well, and it speaks to the fact also that there's a hunger for that, right? And Murray is the guy to definitely bring that message out. And it's a very – I haven't finished it myself, but it's a very clear explanation of how we got into the situation, what the situation is. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, the reason I bring it up is because I think it kind of overlaps with some of the themes that you explore in your book. People would rather pretend that an unwelcome fact doesn't exist than actually wrestle with that fact and come to a rational conclusion, which may be unwelcome, but may actually teach them something about human nature, the world, ideas, danger, all these kinds of things, right?
Yeah, the problem is when you think you have the answers, you stop looking. And so we have a whole bunch of people who have stopped seeking and stopped looking, and instead, you know, the phrase education is from the Latin educare. It means to lead out of. And so they're not leading people out of anything from one state to another. They're basically putting ideas in. And one of the ideas you had asked before about diversity, one of the mechanisms, it's really a frightening thing. One of the mechanisms that they use is inclusion. Do you have that word over there?
Yeah, we do. It comes up from time to time, particularly, again, in the academic context and sometimes in the corporate context.
Right. And so as Jordan Peterson has said, that those ideas spill out of academia in 5 to 7 years. So you have you heard microaggressions?
Oh, yeah. We've got those. That's an argument I have reasonably regularly with some people. This has come out of psychology, right?
Exactly. So those ideas, they start in the university. Usually the nucleation points have something to do with gender studies or something with studies or fields within those orbits. And so you'll probably start hearing inclusion a lot over there. And I apologize for my countrymen on this. So the idea of inclusion is that you it, but all these words sound good. Diversity sounds good. Inclusion sounds good. Safe space, you know, they even resonate with people. Inclusion means that you want to scrub a space, a dialectical space, a verbal space, a physical space of anything that people could consider offensive and could feel hurt by. But the problem is you can feel offensive and be hurt by virtually anything anybody says. Right. It's basically a way to censor speech. That's what an inclusive – that's what a safe space is. That's what inclusion means. It's that people in those conversations can't say anything that could be potentially injurious, you know, cognitively or emotionally injurious to other people in those conversations.
Tell me, when you started writing this, was it a fairly easy thing to lay out the basic problem and then to lay out the solutions? Because I remember when I was a kid, you know, you were told if someone disagrees with you, you listen to them, you figure out what you might learn from their argument. You first of all decide whether or not they make a good enough point in their argument to admit that you're wrong and change your mind accordingly. Or that you then proffer your argument afterwards, and if yours is better, hopefully you convince them and they are able to be mature enough to consider their opinion bested, and then you both emerge from that conversation a little smarter. I mean, is that the basic context for how this works, and is that the premise you moved from?
I'm almost crying from nostalgia for that age. that's part of it. And there's so much. It's such a rich tapestry of, you know, hostage negotiations, multiple lines of literature about cult exiting, applied epistemology, Socratic method. So that's kind of a skeleton. And let's say that it's the case, you know, we have a technique, quote unquote, in the book, a technique, let friends be wrong. Okay, so, you know, you believe something that I don't believe. Well, you know, who cares? Ultimately, what difference does it make? I guess if it's a deal breaker, we talk about in the book, you just can't have a conversation with some. You can't be engaged in a friendship with someone. Well, then you should speak honestly about that. You know, Aristotle says that the highest form of friendship is between two virtuous people. And this madness that we're seeing now prevents people from being forthright in their speech. And when someone is not honest with you in conversation, not only do you not know what they mean, so you can't form a genuine relationship with them, but they don't even know what they mean, right? Because they don't have their ideas tested externally. So what you said is correct. That's part of it. But often people, like, they don't understand exactly what that entails. Like, what does it really mean? And we give in the book, we give line by line, they say this, we say this, you know, how to have conversations across a deep, deep gulf, or how to have a conversation with an ideologue, or if you're trapped at the Thanksgiving table and, you know, your crazy uncle wants to talk about something, you know, how do you deal with that? It's not a Jedi mind trick. It's not complicated. It just takes, you just have to figure it out.
How much of this comes not from your interactions with students or with other crazy academics? How much of it comes from the fact that there are families in the United States at the moment that cannot sit around the dinner table and converse meaningfully with each other, respectfully with each other, because there are perhaps, you know, around the family, two or three people who support Donald Trump and two or three people who like Elizabeth Warren, and that just means that you can't Right. actually mix with each other.
Yeah, that, I don't know how it is over there, but that intense partisan polarization here is just off the scales. I mean, people won't even speak. My daughter was telling me that people sit at different tables based upon the candidates they like, and if there's some kind of a currency to be gained by not sitting at somebody else's table. So a lot of this is motivated by social factors, political polarization. I will say that I don't think that this ideology is sustainable. I think it has several Achilles heels and will eventually kill itself. I don't know when. I could explain why I think that, but I'm positive that this is not a sustainable ideology.
Well, I mean, that would be good. That would be a very welcome conclusion, I should think. And maybe your book will do some work to help get us there. How do you feel we're progressing in terms of these ideas being smashed down? I mean, we've just mentioned Douglas Murray's book. We've talked about yours. I see more and more that there are people breaking through this noise. The comedian Dave Chappelle, for example, has just done a very politically incorrect stand-up routine on an HBO special, which was received with absolute horror by the puritanical, politically correct left. But everybody else is embracing it with open arms. You see how successful people like Jordan Peterson have been on the speaking circuit, filling up enormous venues. His podcasts, Joe Rogan and his podcasts, they've all taken off. This supposed intellectual dark web seems to be on the ascent. And it's not just, you know, angry, disenchanted, middle-class, white, heterosexual men. It seems to be a very, very diverse and very interesting collection of people who are rebelling against this forced narrative.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. And you see the success of Rogan, for example, is a great example of that. I think people are hungry. I really do think that they're hungry for honest, sincere, genuine conversation. They're certainly not getting it in the universities. They're not getting it with their families, especially since tribalism and political, social tribalism, physically, as I told you, the daughter's story, they physically move away from other people. And I think that's been one of the reasons for the successes of these podcasts, because people are hungry. I mean, you know, Aristotle says all men desire to know. Like, we want to know. We want to be social creatures. We want to engage. But the inherent weakness of this ideology is that it doesn't have a defense mechanism. Like, an ideology cannot sustain itself if it does not know the arguments against it.
Well, that's an interesting point. And I always remember hearing Christopher Hitchens say that in the case of atheism, that when he heard fundamentalist Christians, for example, or Muslims or Jews, for the sake of an argument, arguing without any real rational thought, fact, any cohesive argument, it gave him the distinct impression that they'd never heard a good argument against their position, and that for him was tantamount to a good enough reason to stop the conversation there and then and just move away. You're actually encouraging that we don't just move away, that we actually try to bridge these divides.
That's right. I think that's the beginning of the conversation and not the end of the conversation. And, you know, if someone knows something you don't know, you should want to know it too. So it's as much on you. And that's the best posture in which to enter a conversation is, you know, hey, maybe I wonder, how does this person know this? You know, we spend too much time looking at someone's conclusion and not nearly enough time looking at how they arrived at their conclusion. And so, you know, maybe someone knows something I don't know. Okay, so how do they know it? So then you ask questions. Okay, well, you know, simple question. It's a Socratic question, 2,400 years old, probably older than that. How do you know that? And then you explore with targeted questions to see if the way they come to knowledge justifies the claims that they have. And if they do, well, then you might want to think about believing what they claim. And if not, then it's a way to ask them if they really believe what they if the thing that they believe is the thing that they think that they should believe.
Well, you use the
and
word,
most people
you use the word believe. Sorry to interrupt you. You use the word believe. Is that even important? Because actually, sometimes, you know, the best debates in the world are run by people who are given a certain side to argue. And even if they don't personally believe in that side's fact, they argue it to the best of their abilities and sometimes make a very convincing argument for something they don't even believe in. And that's truly something worth admiring.
It is, and that's something else that we've lost. I'm concerned about beliefs because beliefs have consequences. You know, if you believe it's cold, you'll put on a coat. Mm. If you believe someone is an infidel and deserves to die, then you might want to kill them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been criticized viciously because I think that when someone says, for example, you know, I want to kill infidels, I think they're bad, we should thank those people. Not that we should thank them for wanting to kill infidels, but we should thank them for being honest with us about what they want to do. Because only if they're honest with us can we actually figure out a way out of this mess. So when people come to us and say, look, you know, we're an ex Muslim or apostate and these people want to kill us, and then you ask people, do you want to kill them? They say, no, nope, I don't want to kill them. So it right? But when someone is honest with you, you should thank them for that, even if that they hold a repugnant view.
Well, this is often why I find it very disconcerting and hypocritical of some of the people in the identity politics movement and in the far left when they start talking, for example, about, you know, women's rights, and then in the same breath they'll say, well, Islam is great because, of course, brown people. And you think, well, right. there's a disconnect there. There's something that's not making sense, because you're arguing, you can't have two diametrically opposed thoughts in your head at the same time and give them both space and succor, right?
Right. So this is the calculus that they do in their head. There's something called an oppression variable, and different, for example, race is an oppression variable, sexual orientation is an oppression variable, disability status is an oppression variable, and they are hierarchically prioritized. So at the moment, and they change, right? In the 1950s or 40s or beyond, homosexuality was more of an oppression variable. And right now, the trans thing is the biggest oppression variable. And so anything that has anything to do with trans is always privileged. Now, when this is understood, like truly grokked, that's why, for example, black protesters can interrupt gay pride parades, as has happened in the United States. And the reason that they can do that in this intersectional schema is that black people have their oppression variable weighs far more than homosexuality. So it's a way to kind of triage oppression to make the system make sense, to make it internally cohere. But the problem is the whole thing is made up anyway.
Yeah, that is the problem. It's all made up. And I kind of wonder how long it's still got before it completely falls apart. You said earlier you don't think it's sustainable. College campuses have given a place of refuge to this sort of thinking for a long time. I don't know where else it ever really has success, because in the real world, you know, people have bills to pay, they have a life to live, they've got sometimes children to raise, and I think they realize as they get older anyway that a lot of that stuff is all good and well while you're a rebellious teenager, but eventually you have to outgrow it and take on the practicalities of the world. And I think, you know, as I think it was Chesterton who said, you know, in their 20s, anyone who isn't a liberal doesn't have a heart, and in their 40s, anyone who isn't a conservative doesn't have a brain. Do you think that it's also just a function of kind of where we're headed? We hear in America, for example, that, you know, young people, if you surveyed 100 young people, you'd be lucky if you found 30 people who thought that Donald Trump wasn't the devil.
Right.
Especially in the place you live.
Well, okay. Well, I know that's, yeah. So you said a lot there. We got to unpack it. So, but I don't even know where to begin with that.
Sorry.
No, it's just so much. It's such a complicated problem. And, you know, so many people have come in with solutions that are so oversimplified, or they've just looked at one part of the issue. But the universities have been successful. And I want to say this, that I am an atheist and I am a liberal, and I've never attempted to hide that fact from anybody. In fact, quite the contrary. Mm. And I'm telling you in no uncertain terms that a few things. One, if the universities continue to cull conservative voices and then moderate voices and now liberal voices, it is not sustainable. The system, the erosion of public trust in the system will fall. Already, the recent polls that I've read, 80% of conservatives do not trust the university system. That's fairly easy to reverse. Even if it's just a token conservative. Mm. You know, there was a case here at Portland State University where one of my colleagues just had dinner with him last night, Bruce Gilley. He wrote actually the famous paper, The Case for Colonialism, and published it, and then people put death threats about him, et cetera. He put in and he is not a conservative. He's a self-described moderate. At least that's how he's described himself to me. He wanted a course in conservative political thought, and it was rejected because it didn't have enough diversity. So I'll let you think of that. So we can reverse this. It's not complicated.
Well,
go ahead.
All right. That's the first part of the question. The second one is, do you think that there's an effective age on this? Do you think
of an expiration date?
No, I think as you grow older, you become a little better at listening to other people and perhaps at, you know, changing your opinion. Or do you think we get more stuck in our ways?
I don't know the answer to that question. My fear, I will be blunt with you and say, when you said that, my heart seized up. And it seized up because I don't think that's so much of a function of age, although it could be. But if you've grown up in a culture where you're taught that someone who doesn't believe exactly what you believe, and there are ideological purity tests everywhere, isn't just a threat, but an existential threat, then that idea might harden in you as you get older. So it could actually be worse depending on the culture that you live in. I don't know the answer to that question, but it's terrifying. I mean, could you imagine if this sustains itself and then as people get older, they actually become worse?
Yeah, I can see it happening. And you do see a lot of sort of crazy. It happens at academia, for heaven's sake. I'm sure some of your colleagues are more rabid now than they were when they were younger. They were perhaps more inquisitive
when they were
younger. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the perfect word to it. And again, it goes back to ideal laundering, because now they think they have the quote-unquote facts on their side, or the quote-unquote truth that's just been ideal laundered. It's just articles they've pointed to that are untethered to reality. They're totally bogus. They're in make-believe land. And they point to these as if they're some kind of like truths. They're not truths. They're stuff a bunch of ideologues made up.
You and I are both atheists. We're not particularly attached to the idea of religion, but I'm wondering if some of this isn't as a result of the failure of religion in the West, in particular, of the triumph of rationalism in some ways, to the extent that it's an overcompensation, and that now people need to find meaning in nonsense, and the nonsense they're finding is, you know, this political correctness, this leftist orthodoxy, Marxism. Do you think it's filling a gap for some people who require a spiritual well?
That's a great question. A few things. One, we have termed it repeatedly that it's a new religion. And the only reason you need a new religion is because people stop believing in the old. Two, that's called the substitution hypothesis. And I think James Lindsay, the co-author of the book, coined that term. The substitution hypothesis is that people just have a need to believe. And the structures that they have for belief are identical. So, for example, blasphemy and political correctness. Mm-hmm. Original sin is privilege. So they have the same structures, but the content of their belief is different. I'm sorry, did you want to say something?
No. I'm listening, and I'm so far agreeing completely, because I do think that there's a valid argument to be made for the fact that we're just replacing one kind of fundamentalism with another.
Yeah, the question is, and this is kind of an abhorrent, odious question, but if it is the case, and I'm not saying it's the case, but if it is the case that people are just going to believe things because they have these predispositions to belief, then shouldn't we just push them into more benevolent beliefs? And so if it is the case that Christianity is a more benevolent belief, and I never in a million years ever in my whole life would ever have thought, it would be utterly inconceivable that I would have said this, but this new religion, intersectionality and social justice, is really like the aliens have landed. And one way to think about this is that these people do not play by the same rules of engagement. So before, you know, if Dawkins came out with something about evolution, the creationists would attack him, but not him personally. They'd attack his ideas, they'd come to his things, they'd ask questions, they'd have debates, they'd challenge him to debates. But now it's you shout people down, you milkshake people. These are different rules of engagement. So the question is, do we push people toward Christianity, for example, that has a redemption narrative, as opposed to cancel culture, in which you can never be redeemed?
Yeah, you
is
see,
it the case that
I feel like just gonna I feel like people like you and I are suddenly having to look ourselves in the mirror and say, perhaps all this time, the enemy that we thought we had before in irrational religion is not nearly so bad an enemy as the one that we're all collectively facing now. We find ourselves strange bedfellows with the people we used to argue most vociferously with.
Yeah, and I've termed that, and I've spoken about it extensively, I've termed that the Great Realignment. And that's the Great Realignment. And just as there were schisms in the atheist social and atheist movement, skeptical movement, even the comic book movement, all these movements, the schisms, the fault lines in those schisms were along the lines of social justice. Now, in the United States, at least, I think it's worldwide, but don't quote me on that. There's a schism in evangelical Christianity, and the fault line is intersectionality and social justice. In other words, do you need a social justice lens? Do you need an intersectional lens to interpret gospel and scripture? Now, there has been it's been binary But what's fascinating is the social justice atheists and the social justice Christians have aligned with each other against the, we'll call it the correspondence theory of truth. Like the people like me as atheist and Dawkins and it's the list goes down. They've aligned with the non-social justice evangelicals. It has been a great realignment. And it is a fascinating cultural phenomenon because we understand, those of us who find themselves on this side of the divide, we understand what's at stake. We understand the implications of the parasitization of the social justice ideology.
It is an interesting evolution of that position from an original argument. I'm fascinated with this. I think it's terrific that you've written this book. I'm very excited to get into the entire body of it. I've only just skimmed through it. You sent me a copy the other day, but I would encourage anyone else to have a look at it too. It really is a work that I think will have enormous value. Young people, old people, anybody who's finding it difficult to just have, you know, sensible conversation with someone who has a different point of view than you do. Whoever thought we'd get to this? Here we are at the apex of human technological advancement. Here we are at a point where most people that are having these difficulties are also living the best lives that any of their ancestors could ever imagine. They have
exactly. They
have no concerns over famine, over death from bacterial infection. They are not the craven creatures that they descend from, and yet they've lost the ability to sit around the fire and talk to each other and argue in a passionate but not confrontational and destructive manner. It's quite something.
Exactly. And I appreciate this. So this is my life's work. It draws from my experience in prisons and from talking to religious folks. And I sincerely hope, you know, if you ask for a way out, I sincerely hope that if we can get enough people engaging each other, and yeah, will there be a fringe group of ideological maniacs who will not have a conversation with you? Yeah, of course. There's no book you can write to have a conversation about people who don't want to have a conversation. You know, you can't kidnap them and stick them in your trunk and then offer them tea. But for everybody else, right, for the exhausted majority, for everybody else, there is a way forward and there is a way to have these conversations. And it's not complicated. You just follow the templates in the book. It's all there.
Well done to you, Peter. It's always a great privilege to talk to you, and I love your work. Keep on fighting the good fight, because God knows you're in the thick of it in Portland.
Well, I appreciate that. My lament every time I talk to you is that I always wish that we lived closer together and we could hang out and have beers and just shoot the shit.
Yeah, well, one day that may happen. I've got lots of friends out in the West Coast that I need to come and visit. So
I'd love that.
I'll come.
Well,
you
have a place to stay anytime you're here. We'll talk about, we'll solve the world's problems together.
And we won't argue in a hateful way.
That's correct.
Even if we disagree. Thank you so much.
All right, brother. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Great. Peter Boghossian, thank you.
This is CliffCentral.com.